Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
Here's an experiment I'd like you to try at some point today. Find a grain of sand, or even just a super tiny pebble. Put it on the tip of your finger, and then stretch out your arm and hold that grain of sand up to the sky. Now, think about the minuscule area covered by that grain of sand. What could possibly be out there in the universe within such an impossibly small patch of sky? Well, the answer is more than you might dare hope for.
The first focused images that we took, where they were razor sharp, I had the very emotional reaction of, oh my goodness, it works. Personally, I went and had an ugly cry.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and that was Jane Rigby, operations scientist for the James Webb Space Telescope, describing her very understandable reaction to the first images released from the Webb to the public this month. The images, including the Webb's first deep field, show thousands of galaxies, thousands, contained within that tiny, tiny patch of sky covered by the area of the grain of sand on the tip of your finger. They are the deepest, sharpest infrared images of the distant universe that humanity has ever seen. And when I first saw the Webb deep field image, that black backdrop of space literally swimming with galaxies, I felt like we were experiencing the cosmological version of what Dutch scientist Antony van Leeuwenhoek might have felt circa 1670. Now, bear with me here, because that was when van Leeuwenhoek first put droplets of water under a microscope and became the first human to see not a blank and clear droplet, but an entire universe swimming with thousands of microbes. I like to think of van Leeuwenhoek's jaw dropping, looking up from his microscope and wondering if this is what's in but one drop of water? Well then, what else could be out there? Now, about 350 years later, Scott Gowdy, astronomy professor at Ohio State University, had much the same reaction when looking at the Webb telescope's first images. Quote, "You start looking at this image and realize there's no blank sky," he said. "There's something crazy happening everywhere." Well, today, we're going to talk about what the Webb telescope's first images have revealed. And joining us to do that is Catherine Espaillat. She's an astrophysicist and director of Boston University's Institute for Astrophysical Research. Her work focuses on young stars and how planets form around that. Professor Espaillat, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also with us today is Stephen Finkelstein. He joins us from Austin, Texas. He's a professor of astronomy at the University of Texas, and his work focuses on galaxies from the earliest millions of years of the universe. Professor Finkelstein, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let me ask you both, and Professor Espaillat, I'll start with you. When you saw the images first released from the Webb this month, like, really, what was your first reaction?
I mean, my mind was just blown. It's like I was expecting to see something amazing, and it was even more spectacular than I could have imagined. And every single image that keeps coming out is just more and more beautiful than the last one. And I'm just so excited to enter this new era of discovery with JWST. And yeah, it's just a lot of excitement, happiness, joy, that humanity gets to see the universe in a way we never have before.
Yeah. So what was the more than you could have possibly imagined part, right? Because we have had like mind-blowing images for years now from Hubble. So what did JWST provide that really sort of took it to the next level for you?
You know, the first image that comes to mind is that one of the Carina Nebula, which is one of the first four that was released. It's a star-forming region with young stars. And, you know, this is my research area. I know there's young stars in there. I know there's gas and dust. But then, you know, I keep zooming in to that image, and I keep zooming in and zooming in, and there's something there. There's dust there. That just really amazed me, just the fine resolution that we're getting with JWST. And then the other day, another image came out with, it's called the Phantom Galaxy. And it looks like, when you're looking at it, it looks like you're falling down like a well, or like a, it looks very like there's movement. You can kind of see the spiral arms of the galaxy, the bright stars. A lot of excitement. Like, yeah, I knew scientifically, yes, we're going to see things at high resolution. But then actually seeing it, it's just like a really emotional, happy experience.
Yeah. Professor Finkelstein, how about you? What was your first response?
Very similar. We've seen simulated images of what we think we would see with this telescope after it launched. And just a very similar reaction. It blew my expectations out of the water. All the images were beautiful, I think, in terms of artistic reaction. I think definitely the Carina Nebula. For me, it was really that Webb's first deep field, the galaxy cluster image. Not only seeing the number of galaxies in the image, which is, you know, something we expected to see, but the level of detail. And every new image I look at is the level of detail you see in nearby galaxies, but even in quite distant galaxies. That's really surprised me. And one other reaction that I just didn't even expect was from the Stevens Quintet image. That was that image of those four interacting galaxies with another galaxy along the line of sight. That's a pretty nearby, in astronomical terms, a pretty nearby object or collection of objects. And I think any other image you look at that, you're really only going to see those galaxies, maybe some stars in our own galaxy in the foreground and a few faint smudges. And when you look at that as it was taken with JWST and you look in the background, there's actually a deep field in the background. There's extremely distant galaxies all over that image. And it just shows you how powerful this telescope is. You don't actually have to observe that long to find galaxies in the early universe.
Well, I mean, as I quoted that other scientist saying, that other astronomer saying, it's like this crazy stuff happening everywhere. Is that hyperbole, you think, either of you, or not?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Go ahead, Catherine.
No, I think that's a great quote. Like, everywhere we look, there's going to be something happening that we haven't thought of before. And it's going to really force us to, like, come up with the simulations and the physics to be able to explain it. I really love that quote.
Yeah. Well, you know what I want to do? A little later in the show, I actually want to talk in detail about the first images and see them through your eyes. But first, before that, I just want to remind folks exactly, you know, some of the engineering and specifics around what's making it possible for the Webb Space Telescope to capture these images. So first of all, it's way out there, right? It's like, what, a million miles or so from planet Earth, Professor Espaillat?
Yes, it is. Four times further away than the moon is from Earth. It's pretty out there.
Okay, and it's at a special point in terms of why scientists and engineers decided to put it there.
Yeah, it's at a point called L2, which is a point in the solar system where, because of the conjunction of the sun's gravity and the Earth's gravity, an object can go around the sun in about a year, which is Earth's orbit, which is what we want, because we want the telescope to be close enough to us that we can get we can communicate with it pretty quickly, relatively quickly.
Okay. What's interesting about it, I mean, like, the engineering of this telescope is just so marvelous to me, right? Like, it has this giant, huge sun shield, because obviously it doesn't want to get fried by the sun's energy. But then it has that beautiful hexagonal mirror as well. Now, Professor Finkelstein, what exactly is the data that the James Webb Space Telescope is taking in?
So it's taking lots of different kinds of data. Most of what we've seen so far are imaging data. The telescope does have many instruments. The bulk of the images that were released come from the NIRCam instrument. It's the near-infrared camera. But one of the first images was also a spectrum. That was the one we saw of the exoplanet atmosphere. And there are multiple instruments on the telescope capable of doing that, taking a light from a source, splitting it apart into its component colors. And that lets us learn things like what objects are made of, whether it's our own stars in our nearby galaxy, to exoplanets thousands of light years away, to galaxies billions of light years away.
Mm-hmm. So, but about the infrared camera, why infrared? Because, I mean, people hear that term and think, well, heat. So how is it, mm-hmm. what's important to take essentially heat pictures of as far into the universe as we can see?
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it, because heat is why it's out at L2 at this point a million miles away, because the Earth is radiating in the infrared quite strongly because the Earth is warm. It has a temperature. And so by putting the telescope at L2, we keep the big sun shield keeping not only the sun and the telescope on opposite sides, but the sun shield actually also blocks out the Earth and the moon. But scientifically, okay. observing in the infrared gives us a huge advantage over the Hubble Space Telescope, which observed primarily in the visible. You can understand different phenomena in the universe at different wavelengths. And the particular topic I work on of distant galaxies, we really do need this infrared light because the universe is expanding. And so that means that all galaxies are moving away from our own. And the more distant galaxies are moving more quickly. And when an object moves away from you, its light actually gets stretched, and that makes it appear redder. And you get to a point where more distant galaxies are moving away from us so quickly that all of their light is shifted out of the visible wavelength regime and into the infrared. So we simply could not study the early universe with Hubble. We needed an infrared telescope to do that.
Oh, fascinating. And then does the infrared also apply to the work that you're doing, Professor Espaillat?
Yes. So in the infrared, we can detect warm water in close to stars. And we're interested in that because we want to figure out, where kind of Earth-like planets form or Earth formed. Was there water there when Earth was forming? And so we need the material to be close enough to the star that we can detect it. And the infrared is where it comes out. And also there's a lot of dust. So we're talking about dust grains that are smaller than the width of a human hair, and they emit primarily in the infrared. We also want to understand the dust that's around these stars that the planets are made up of.
Got it. So that, and for that particular infrared camera then, that data comes into the Webb telescope, but it's then processed into the visual images that we, all of humanity, were first allowed to see this month when the James Webb Space Telescope gave us a glimpse of what might be possible out there in the big, big, giant, infinite universe of ours. So we're talking about what those images tell us through the eyes of two astronomers. We'll be back in just a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a look at those first images from the James Webb Space Telescope, but we're doing it through the eyes of two astronomers. And joining us today is Catherine Espaillat. She's an astrophysicist and director of Boston University's Institute for Astrophysical Research. Her work focuses on young stars and planet formation. Stephen Finkelstein also joins us as well. He's with us from Austin, Texas. He's a professor of astronomy at the University of Texas, and he looks at things much farther away, the earliest story of the universe. And we're getting lots of comments here. By the way, if you've got questions for Professor Espaillat or Professor Finkelstein, do hop on Facebook or Twitter. We're at On Point Radio. Renee Shapiro on Facebook is saying, "This is so awe-inspiring, especially to those of us who no longer live in a place where the awesomeness of the night sky has been obliterated by light pollution." Good point, Renee, because I was just up in northwestern Montana a couple of months ago, and seeing an unobstructed, unpolluted night sky is really quite a transformational view. Now, I'd like to go through again some of the early images with both of you and tell us a little bit more about what you're seeing. So first of all, Professor Finkelstein, let's just go back to, again, the deep field, okay? Because that's where we started here. And I am on the Webb Telescope's website here, which is super cool, by the way. And they provided zoomable images, which is amazing. So when you're looking at the deep field image, how would you describe it, Professor Finkelstein?
I'm trying to think. I guess I would describe it as at a loss for words. I also brought up the image so I could look at it. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful in a completely different way. Every one of these images, it's beautiful in their own way. What is always so striking about this is the gravitational lensing that you can see. This is a known phenomenon where if you have a very massive object in the universe, it can actually bend light around it. This is something that has been predicted from Einstein, and we've verified time and time again, and now we're using it to our advantage. We use a sort of moderately distant, very massive object, in this case a galaxy cluster, the most massive objects in the universe. And it's acting like a cosmic magnifying lens, and it's magnifying galaxies behind it. And what that does is it actually stretches them out on the sky, and it takes an object that, without that galaxy cluster in the way, might be a tiny little dot. Maybe you could see it, maybe not, and you wouldn't see it in a lot of detail. And it stretches it out and makes it a lot brighter, and you can actually start to pick apart individual star clusters in these galaxies. Mm.
In this image, that's amazing. I mean, because I'm looking at it here, and you definitely see with like spectacular clarity spiral galaxies. There's sort of more sort of nebulae looking galaxies to me. How far away or how far back in time is this image looking?
Almost all the way. So I always like to think in terms of time. Our universe is about 13.8 billion years old. And when we look at objects that are far away, we're seeing them as they were in the past, because light takes time to travel. And so the farther away we look, the farther we can see. And that's a great feature of the universe that lets us actually do galaxy evolution, because we can see galaxies as they were at different times. And some of the small, faintest, reddest dots in this image are coming from a time probably only a few hundred million years after the Big Bang. So we're seeing the first few percent of the universe in action.
And why is it important to understand that early, early phase of the universe?
Lots of answers to that, and I will give you my favorite one, which is that I think it's the ultimate human origin story. Many different fields of science and even outside of science try to study where we came from where humanity came from, where our Earth came from, where our solar system came from. And I look at the study of galaxy evolution as where our Milky Way galaxy came from. We know that galaxies evolve with time, and we want to understand what did the first little small galaxy that eventually became something like our Milky Way, what was that like, and how is it different from our own galaxy today?
So I'm about to ask you a question, which I don't know if it's a good one or not, but I can't help myself here. When you look at an image like the deep field, and as a scientist, you're thinking, well, what area do we want to focus on next? Like, how do you make that decision? You're like, well, maybe in that sort of the upper left-hand quadrant, there might be something interesting there. Or like, how do you do that?
Yeah, so that sort of in two ways. One would be literally just looking at it, like you and I are doing right now, and saying, huh, that source looks interesting. Let's focus in and measure something from that source. And a separate way would be using sort of automated software that we have that will find all of the galaxies, all of the stars, all of the little bright things in the image, and it will measure how bright they are. And then we can actually use computers to study these in more detail and use computers to sort of pull out what the interesting objects are. Because while our eyes are great, they're particularly biased because they have our brains sort of telling them what to do.
Okay. Oh my gosh. So it's just, I don't know, like being in a field where it's just like a constant act of discovery must be a thrill every day, even through all the hard work as well. So Professor Espaillat, let's move on to you, the image that you mentioned at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Is it the cosmic cliffs? Yeah. So first of all, what area of the sky are we looking at in this picture?
So we're looking towards the constellation Carina, and the nebula is called the Carina Nebula because it's in that constellation. And then we're actually looking at just a little piece of the nebula. In particular, we're looking at on the bottom of the image, you see it's like cloudy material. You see a bunch of little stars, and on the top, it kind of looks like it's cleared out. And that's because they're looking at a part of the nebula where there's some very, very big energetic stars that are not in the image. They're to the upper right, and they're so bright and energetic and so hot that they're clearing out the material in the nebula around themselves. And what we're seeing with that curve that you see that people are calling the cliffs, that's actually the edge of the inner edge of the nebula, where that's facing, getting that radiation from the higher mass stars. And what I'm interested in, the science that I do, I'm interested in looking in those little red dots that you see towards the bottom of the image that are kind of embedded in the cloud, because those are the young baby stars that are forming. And that's what I'm going to be interested in picking them out, seeing how many are there. And then around those young baby stars, there should be planets that are forming. So that's the part of the image that I'm particularly excited about, which is, I think, what doesn't draw most people's attention. They're looking like the edge and the cliffs, and I'm just looking at like these little red fuzzy dots.
Well, that's so true because like the image first captures you, because to me it looks like this like giant cosmic wave of red fluids of some kind, but obviously it's gas. Yeah. And then against this like backdrop of the black and blue star-filled space. I should say, these colors, I mean, are these, do we know if these colors are accurate? Because they come out of the processing of the images. If we were able to actually see these with our own eyes in the visible spectrum, are these the colors we would see?
No. So with our human eyes, we wouldn't see the image like this. So it's been color-coded. It's been processed. So this is a near-infrared image. So our eyes can't see near-infrared. If we were to look at this patch of sky with our eyes, what we would see is the bright O stars. The really bright, massive stars. They're called O stars. And they're not actually in the image. They're towards the upper right. And then each of the stars, you would see the pinpoints of light in the optical with our eyes, which is where our eyes are tuned to, but you wouldn't see any of those cliffs. You wouldn't see any of that because that's all emitting in the near infrared. So you would see the stars because stars still emit in the near infrared and the visible wavelengths, the optical wavelengths that our eyes are tuned to, but we wouldn't see those beautiful, majestic cliffs.
Got it. So I'm just zooming in on that sort of part at the bottom you were talking about. And you're really talking about the baby stars are just like the tiny little dots?
Yep, the tiny little dots.
There are so many of them.
Thousands. I can't wait to look at them all and see what we can learn. But yeah, those are all the baby stars. And you have to imagine that around those baby stars are baby planets forming entire planetary systems. And there's thousands of them. Yeah, we heard about, you know, from Stephen that there's thousands of galaxies in that little image. I love that analogy you did of the grain of sand on your fingertip. Well, around those, in those galaxies with, you know, thousands of galaxies, there's billions of stars. And around those billions of stars, there's like tons of planets. So the numbers just get more and more mind-boggling when you think about it.
And how is Webb offering you, or what measurements is it offering you that will let you know if there's a young forming exoplanet around any of these stars?
Yeah, so there is, I think the most promising is the imaging in the near infrared, because as planets are forming, they're emitting, they're pretty hot, and so they're cooling down, and they're emitting a lot of in the near infrared. So with NIRCam, we can actually point these, point a JWST looking at these young stars, and we'll be able to see protoplanetary disks around them. And protoplanetary disks, you can think of them as like a pancake kind of around the star. That's where the gas and dust is, where the planets form out of. And inside of those pancakes, you can see the little protoplanets. So far, we've detected two using ground-based infrared telescopes, but with JWST, we're expecting to see a lot more.
Huh. And I heard Professor Finkelstein saying hello there. Professor, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Sorry about that. I had a little internet hiccup.
No, that's okay. Internet hiccups are literally a daily part of everyone's life now. I wanted to ask you, Professor Finkelstein, if the Carina image that Professor Espaillat was talking about, if there's data in there that's related to your research about the earliest moments of the universe?
Definitely indirectly. So as you all have been talking about, this is showing us where stars are forming. And one of the things I'm most interested to learn about the early universe is how does the process of star formation there differ from what we see locally in our galaxy? And in our own galaxy, we can see these beautiful images and study star formation in great detail to the point where you can see individual stars forming. And we can't do that in the distant universe. We sort of have to do it from a very far out viewpoint on these galaxies. We study the brightness of the galaxy as a whole. And from that, we can infer how many stars are forming in that galaxy. And then we can take another zoom out view and look at a collection of galaxies at a particular time of the universe and see how many stars are forming. And that's one of the biggest sort of numbers that we try to calculate is how much star formation is happening in the universe at different times. And I think already we are seeing hints from the earliest JWST papers that are coming out, including one that our team will be submitting here in just a few hours, that the early universe has much more star formation going on than we would have thought possible if early universe galaxies were as bad at forming stars as our own Milky Way. Because our Milky Way forms stars, but it's not actually that great at it. It's very inefficient.
Okay. So what does that mean then? How does that change our understanding of the earliest moments of the universe?
The hints that we're seeing is that galaxies exist at times that most theoretical simulations that theoretical astrophysicists run would predict they don't. And so that means that the physical processes that, you know, the smartest minds in our field thought were at play, something needs to be modified. And this is how science works. We had predictions for a period of time that we hadn't gotten to observe yet. We now make these observations and we need to revise our models to better match what we actually see. And there are, I'm sure, many things that could or need to be changed. But the biggest one to me seems to be something about how the process of star formation occurs. It seems to be happening much more rapidly, much more efficiently in these early tiny galaxies.
Isn't that marvelous? I mean, you could hear what you just said, Professor Finkelstein, and think, oh, well, you know, what a failure then of those brightest minds creating those models. But it's like the exact opposite, right? It's the exact opposite. It's like, wow, we weren't quite right. There's something else going on. Now let's discover what it is.
That's exactly right. And I'm an observational astrophysicist, so I look at things with telescopes, but I collaborate with many theoretical astrophysicists. And I think that's kind of the mindset you have to have is you take your best stab using your best ideas of how astrophysics works to make a prediction. And then if you observations match your prediction, great. But if they don't, that's where the exciting work happens. When your model is wrong, then you need to get down to work and say, okay, what can we actually change that will better match what we see in the early universe? But we'll also match everything else that we've observed. Models are really good at matching the present day universe, so you can't do anything that messes that up either.
Yeah. Professor Espaillat, is that one of the things about being an astrophysicist that keeps you going? That in a sense, it's like it's this sort of beautiful constant act of humility, if I can put
it
that way.
No, definitely. That I was going to say, yeah, it's just you have to be really humble. You know, I'm in the my work, I do observations, but I also do some theory and I try to apply the theoretical models to the observations. So I'm really, you know, it's kind of like I'm excited to see what JWST is going to bring and force me to change in the models. But then I'm also like, oh my gosh, it's going to be so much work. You don't have to get it right. So I'm also like a little bit anxious too about just how much are we going to have to change here? What are we talking about? But it's also exciting because, you know, this is how science gets done. I'm really looking forward to all the data that's coming in, even though it means I'm going to have to be changing a lot of my models.
It's a mindset that we need more of,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
we're living sort of, terrestrially, we're living in kind of an absolutist world.
Yeah, so we just have to roll with it, and the universe is going to give us what it's going to give us, right? And you just have to, like, make sense of it. And, like, it's also really humbling to think that, you know, there's so much out there. We don't even know what we don't know, right? And JDC is going to help us understand more of it, but there's still going to be more out there that we don't understand than we actually understand.
Well, so on that note, let me just quickly get in a listener question here, because someone wants to know, can you give us details about how JWST will give us new and better understanding of dark matter and or dark energy? I don't know who the best person is to take that question. Is that you, Professor Finkelstein?
Mm-hmm. Maybe I could take a stab at it. So dark matter and dark energy, you know, they're 95% of the composition of our universe, but the part we understand the least. One thing that we've been thinking about just over this weekend is the best idea of what dark matter is that it's some kind of particle that we just haven't discovered yet. And the longer scientists go without discovering that particle, there are many particle physics experiments around the world trying to identify a dark matter particle. The more different ideas come out of, well, maybe it's not that kind of particle. Maybe it's a less massive particle. Maybe it's something else. And one of the alternative ideas that have been coming out is just that it's a lighter type of particle known as warm dark matter. The standard sort of accepted theory of dark matter is that it's called cold dark matter. And that just has to do with the mass of the particle. But if you look at predictions from cold dark matter versus warm dark matter, warm dark matter cannot make galaxies in the early universe, at least not so early. And so by detecting early galaxies, we can immediately rule out an entire class of alternative dark matter models.
Huh. Well, today we are taking a look at those first images from the James Webb Space Telescope, and we're looking at them through the eyes of two astronomers, Catherine Espaillat and Stephen Finkelstein. We'll have a lot more with them when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are looking at those first images from the James Webb Space Telescope, but we're looking at them through the eyes of two astronomers. They are Stephen Finkelstein. He joins us from Austin, Texas. He's a professor of astronomy at the University of Texas. He studies galaxies from the earliest moments of the universe. We're also joined from Boston by Catherine Espaillat. She's an astrophysicist and director of Boston University's Institute for Astrophysical Research. Her work focuses on young stars and planet formation. And Professor Espaillat, we've got a question here that's come in on Facebook, a listener seeking a clarification, because we were talking about those cosmic cliffs of Carina a few minutes ago. And Ron Schofield says, regarding what we could possibly see with the naked eye, he understood your explanation about what would be blocked out if we were at a distance from that part of the universe. But if we were much closer to the nebula, would it look to us visually as it does in the enhanced photograph? Thank you, Ron says.
So we would see some. So the best comparison I can make is the Orion Nebula, which is in the Orion constellation. With the naked eye, you can see like a little fuzzball where the Orion Nebula is. And if you have binoculars, you can kind of start to make out a kind of a cloudy appearance. So yes, you could. And it depends on how good we were talking about how there's no really like good night skies anymore. Like there's so much light pollution. So it depends on how dark is the area you're in and are you using binoculars or not. So you would see something fuzzy in the sky, but definitely not to that kind of level of detail that we're seeing with JWST.
Yeah, of course, right? Because we would be here on Earth. But I guess the question is, like, suppose we were somehow transported physically much closer to the nebula.
Oh, yeah.
Is it orange? And, like, would it look like the picture?
It wouldn't look exactly like the picture because that's an infrared picture that's been color-coded. But we would see in the visible, we would be able to see some emission in the visible. So we would see some kind of colors. It'd be mostly, like, whitish. Maybe with a bluish tinge because of the O stars. But it wouldn't look exactly like that because we had to remember that's a processed image. It's been color-coded.
Yeah. Okay, so let me just, before we go on to the next piece of data that came in, Professor Finkelstein, let's just continue on this line of thought because people naturally who aren't astronomers want to think about the universe. So do I, in terms of like what we can take in with our own senses, right? But these images are showing us perhaps more proof than we already have about what is the vast amount of information contained in the universe well beyond the senses of human beings. Professor Finkelstein, you there?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm always speechless, but I have to hear questions. Definitely well beyond the senses.
I hope it's not because they're terrible questions.
No, they're good. They're really good questions. The questions I haven't heard before, let's put it that way. They're good questions. So to go along that same line of thought, these galaxies, if you could try to look at them with your own eyes from Earth, you would not see them. They're literally invisible because all their light is coming out in the infrared. But if you could transport yourself 13 billion years into the past and be next to them and see them, they would look quite blue. Because they are so heavily star forming, they have many, many, many massive stars. Massive stars are really hot, which makes them really blue. And so it would look like this sort of compact, blue, glowy cloud of stars.
You know, for some reason, my mind right now is going back to a conversation we did many weeks ago with a science writer, Ed Yong, because his new book is about how all the different ways animals on planet Earth take in information about their environments, all the sensory inputs that they have that we don't. And so this is just like another example of how human beings, we need to be okay with the fact that we are very small. Mm-hmm. We are very limited. And it's instruments like the Webb telescope that are letting us sort of experience more, giving us windows onto things that we would never otherwise have. Professor Espaillat, did you want to say something to that?
No, I was just going to add, like, yeah, we're limited by, you know, our biology, but our imaginations, like we imagine JWST, right? We're imagining these things. So our brain has like a really huge capacity to, you know, to think about that there's more out there than we can even see. So I do want to give us a little bit of credit too, that as a species, we're very curious.
That's, you make a good point there because it's absolutely the human species which created this telescope. So point well taken. So let's talk about some other kinds of information that are coming in from the JWST. Now, there is some atmospheric data, Professor Espaillat, that you had mentioned earlier from a gas giant exoplanet. I'm seeing here it's called WASP-96b. Mm-hmm. Where is WASP-96b?
So it's very close. We've been talking about things that are very far away, but this is in our cosmic backyard. It's within 500 light years of us. which is really, it sounds far, but it's actually really close compared to the galaxies we've been talking about. And yeah, it's a gas giant planet. It's like Jupiter, and that spectrum. So again, as we were talking about earlier, it's breaking up light into its different components, and it has a signature of water in the atmosphere. So you may or may not know that Jupiter has water in its atmosphere, and looking at this planet was kind of a test case. Can we detect water in the atmospheres of planets? And of course, this one's very big, so it's very bright, so it's easier to detect the water, but it makes it really promising for us to keep pushing down on the mass of the planets to see how low mass planet can we go, and can we detect water in the atmosphere of those planets, because of course, when we're thinking about life, we think most immediately of, you know, what is life like? Can life look like what we have here on Earth, carbon-based, and it needs a lot of water? So we're usually looking for water when we're thinking about finding signatures of life somewhere else.
Yeah, so this is a really cool image. I mean, it's really the wavelength image we're looking at here. Yeah. And by the way, just as a little aside, when you said so Jupiter has measurable water vapor in its atmosphere, but also mm-hmm. some of the Jovian moons do, right? I think yes. Didn't Hubble capture like a giant geyser of water vapor off Europa?
Yes.
Did I remember that correctly?
Yes. So, the Jupiter's moons, some of them are icy, some of them have water, and actually Europa has, we think it has a, we have evidence that it has a hard, icy water surface, and then underneath it should have liquid water. And of course, we're really excited about that because liquid water, we think that could be, you know, habitable for life. So we may have life in our solar system, right in our backyard, but of course we have to send missions to Jupiter to further explore that. And there is a mission that's planned to go up next year, the Clipper, Europa Clipper mission, they'll be heading out there.
Okay. So I glossed over something which I shouldn't have. This WASP-96b image from Webb, an exoplanet was picked because, you know, it was relatively close and really big, so it was easily observable. Mm-hmm. But did it surprise you that, like, this first one that Webb looked at, there was a clear water signature in the atmosphere?
Yeah, it like everything is surprising. Like you pick the best one and you hope for the best, and then it's like, wow. Of course, you know, that, of course, the, you know, different water can appear different. It depends on the model that you're using, right? So this is really going to stir a lot of work in the field to refine our models and see, because what are the fainter water signatures that we can get from smaller mass planets?
It amazes me, though, that it was like the first one and water, the signature of water was found there, because yeah. It makes me wonder, is it much, 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 much more common in the universe than we thought?
Well, we think water is everywhere. It's just a question of, okay, is it in the right place in order for it to make it to the planet, in order for the planet to be habitable?
Got it. Okay. So when you say we're going to also then look sort of down in terms of trying to find planets that aren't necessarily gas giants, but rocky later.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So definitely there's going to be plans to look at like rocky planets, like our Earth, and trying to look at the atmospheres of those planets. Those are going to be much more challenging, but JWST is the best instrument the best facility that we have to do it. So we're definitely going to be taking a look at those.
Okay, Professor Finkelstein, I appreciate your patience here. Just would love to hear your thoughts about that, the sign of the presence of water in the atmosphere of WASP-96b.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely outside my field, but it's fascinating. You know, we often think of water as necessary for life, and in this type of planet, the type of way we're seeing the water, that's likely not what we're seeing there in the atmosphere of a gas giant. But it, you know, just provides further evidence to something we already thought, that water is pretty ubiquitous out there in the universe. And so if we can, you know, train our eyes towards smaller, rockier planets where it might be able to have a liquid form, that's going to be where the real excitement lies.
Okay, so we have another question here coming in from Twitter. Linda Hauber-Wall says she's been hearing references to the images being color-coded, but what exactly does that mean? Could you explain that a bit? I mean, Professor Finkelstein, I'll toss that one to you.
Sure, yeah. So we've talked about how this is an infrared telescope. And so if your eyes could see the photons, the light particles the telescope sees, they would not be sensitive to them. Our eyes are sensitive to visible light because that's where most of our sun puts out light. So that's how we've evolved. And so what we do is we want to make an image we can see, right? If we put out Webb's first image and it was just a blank screen, that wouldn't be very exciting. So Webb can observe in multiple different filters. And so it can look at bluer infrared light. That would be higher energy infrared light and lower energy infrared light. We might call that redder infrared light. And we can combine those images in a way where we take the bluer infrared light and make that blue on our computer screens, the redder infrared light and make that red on our computer screens. And so whether we call it color coding or false colors, it's doing our best to represent how these objects would look if our eyes could see infrared light.
Okay. Another good question here, because in the last few minutes, let's talk about sort of carrying the research forward, both in terms of the data that Webb is bringing back and maybe some next generation space telescopes. But first of all, about the JWST, D. Campbell wants to know about that micrometeor that recently hit the JWST. D. says it was larger than the scope the telescope was designed for. So what does this say about the expected useful lifetime of the telescope? Professor Espaillat, you want to hazard an answer for that one?
From what I've heard, the telescope recovered pretty well, and there isn't an expectation for it to impact the scientific observations. Stephen, I don't know if you've heard differently than that.
No, that's exactly what I've heard as well. We always expected it was going to be hit by a micrometeorite. Space is not, it's pretty empty, but it's not completely empty. I think the surprising thing was the size of this impact and the fact that it happened so quickly. But given that it was just one over now several months in space, I don't think there's too big of a worry about the impact on the mission as a whole.
Up until now, but it's supposed to potentially, because the launch and the deployment of the Webb went so really without a hitch, I'm seeing that there that in terms of fuel on board of the space telescope, it could operate for some 20 years. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a really long time. I mean, unlike Hubble, you can't go out there and fix it if something. If something goes wrong with the Webb. But who knows what we'd be able to do in 20 years. So Professor Espaillat, let me just ask you, like, this is a kind of projection that I know scientists don't like to do. But, you know, can you just imagine some of the types of questions that you may want to ask or your students in the future with the data that the Webb could bring back?
Yeah, I think the big question we want to ask is, how do stars and planets form? And then, like, kind of really digging down into the smaller questions, the answer to that would be, you know, how long does it take the star to build up? You know, you have the Carina Nebula. It's a big nebula full of gas and dust, and there are a lot of nebula out there. But then how long does it take for that material to actually condense and form a star? And then for the planets, how much material is around these stars? Is there enough material there in order to make different planetary systems, maybe like our own solar system? Like, so how much dust is there? How much gas is there? And then, you know, I mentioned earlier water. So, you know, we know Earth has water on it, but where did that water come from? Did it come from, did the Earth just kind of accumulate it because the water was nearby, or was it transferred to the Earth from a comet that came from the outer solar system? Using JWST, we'll be able to tell where is the water in these planetary systems, and is it close to the star where rocky planets form, or is it from further out in the planetary system where the gas giants form?
Got it. You know, we only have 2 minutes left here, and I guess I just want to wrap it up by bringing it back from, you know, the furthest reaches of the universe back to the two of you. Professor Finkelstein, what drew you to the field of astronomy to begin with?
I've always loved space. I remember as a kid loving space, as a teenager loving space. But it wasn't until high school. I had an amazing high school physics teacher, Mr. Half, if you're listening. I'm not sure you're in Seattle. He really got me into the field. There was a unit on gravity, and I just fell in love and decided then, without really knowing much about what the career was like, that I was going to major in astronomy. And I don't really know what I was thinking. I was 17, but I figured it out after that. But it was really, really just one amazing teacher that got me hooked.
Oh, amazing. And what about you, Professor Espaillat?
I remember being really young and watching like Nova on TV, PBS, and watching like all these beautiful images of stars and galaxies and just being amazed that these things were out there. I grew up in New York City with a lot of light pollution. So when I'd look up, I'd see maybe one or two stars. And it just blew my mind that there was all of this out there. And I was like, well, I want to go figure out how to do it. And I didn't know at the time this was a job. Like I could get paid to like look at the universe. But eventually when I got to college, I figured out, hey, like this is something I can actually do. And then I just started taking astronomy courses and I just kept falling deeper and deeper in love with astronomy. And I'm just so privileged and happy that this is my job.
Oh my gosh, that is amazing. So when you were growing up, you couldn't just like look up above you and see all those stars. It was that, well, look, now you both of you have the most powerful sort of space telescope.
Yes.
To help overcome those childhood wants from you, Catherine. But I, as more and more data comes in, and I know, Catherine, you've got some time with the scope next year. When information from that comes in, I'd love to have both of you back on the show. So let me just thank you from the bottom of my heart. Stephen Finkelstein, professor of astronomy at the University of Texas, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Catherine Espaillat, astrophysicist and director of Boston University's Institute for Astrophysical Research. Thank you so much as well.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.